Beloved congregation in our Lord Jesus Christ, our text for this morning is Psalm 83. We have here the last of a series of psalms written by Asaph, the series of psalms that begins with Psalm 73. One of the things about those psalms of Asaph is that they are frequently psalms of complaint or psalms of lament. And several of those psalms, in fact, focus on enemies of Israel and on their attacks on the people of God. We saw, for example, that Psalm 74 is a psalm that mourns the destruction of the temple. Psalm 79, a psalm that mourns the destruction of Jerusalem. Psalm 80 is a psalm that prays for the restoration of God's vine. And here we have a prayer against a great confederacy of nations, against the people of God. The tents of Edom and the Ishmaelites, Moab and the Hagrites, Gebel, Ammon and Amalek, Philistia with the inhabitants of Tyre, Assyria and the children of Lot. Now there's no specific historical occasion that seems to fit very well with the circumstances described in this psalm. The closest in the historical record of the Old Testament seems to be the attack on Israel made during the reign of Jehoshaphat by Moab, Ammon, and Edom. That attack on Israel is recorded in 2 Chronicles 20. 2 Chronicles 20. And there is actually in that account language that's similar to the language of this psalm. In that attack on Israel made by Moab, Ammon, and Edom, Jehoshaphat prayed to the Lord, and here's some of his words from that prayer. Here they are, that is Moab, Ammon, and Edom, rewarding us by coming to throw us out of your possession, which you have given us to inherit. The other nations, however, that are mentioned here in the psalm are not mentioned in connection with that historical event. So it's possible also that the psalm was written at some other time on the occasion of some other event that's not recorded for us in the scriptures. But I'd like you to consider also a different possibility. And that is that this psalm represents instead of a particular historical occasion, the history of Israel from the time of David onward. And represents then all the traditional enemies of Israel gathered in alliance, not in an actual earthly alliance, but gathered in that great alliance of the seed of the serpent against the seed of the woman. So that what we have here in the psalm is not a particular event, but rather a characterization of the history of Israel and of the history of the church, as the seed of the serpent makes war on the seed of the woman. We should notice that Asaph does in this psalm pick up the prayer of Deborah and Barak in Judges chapter 5. As Deborah and Barak were celebrating the victory of Israel over the Canaanites, they ended their song of celebration with these words, "So let all your enemies perish, O Lord." And that is echoed in this psalm, especially in verse 17. Yes, let them be put to shame and perish. The psalm is entirely prayer. The first part of the psalm is dominated by that petition of the first verse, "Do not keep silent, O God," and then the description of the alliance against Israel. And the second part of the psalm is dominated by a series of petitions against those enemies. So let's consider the psalm under the theme, praying against a wicked confederacy. First, a great conspiracy, and secondly, urgent petitions. One feature of the psalm that may support the idea that this is a broad view of the history of Israel rather than a reference to a particular historical occasion is that in that list of nations that we find in verses 5, 6, 7, and 8, there are 10 nations there. It's not impossible, therefore, that instead of trying to list a specific group of enemies at a specific time, the psalmist took these 10 nations as representative of all the nations of Israel, using that symbolic number of the scriptures, that number that signifies completeness, and that we find elsewhere in the scriptures with regard to the enemies of God's people. You find it, for example, in the vision of Daniel in Daniel 7, verse 7. Daniel saw in that vision a number of different beasts, and the last and the greatest of those beasts is described in verse 7. After this, I saw in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrible, exceedingly strong. It had huge iron teeth. It was devouring, breaking in pieces, and trampling the residue with its feet. It was different from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. And you find also in Revelation mention of a great beast. In chapters 12 and 13 and 17, this beast is described for us. And one of the things about this beast is that it has 7 heads and 10 horns and 10 crowns upon its 10 horns. So it seems to me that that number 10 here may be representative of all the enemies of Israel, in fact, of all the enemies of God's people throughout the ages of the world. Some of the nations listed here in Psalm 83 are nations that we know quite well from many other scriptural passages about them. There are the Edomites and the Moabites and the Ammonites and the Amalekites and the Assyrians and so on. There are a couple of these nations that we don't know much at all about. The Hagrites, for example. Some commentators think that these Hagrites were, along with the Ishmaelites, descendants of Hagar. That's not impossible. They are found in the record of the scriptures also in 1 Chronicles chapter 5. In 1 Chronicles 5, we have the genealogy of Reuben. That first part of 1 Chronicles is all genealogies. In that chapter is the genealogy of Reuben. And you find there in verse 10 this language. Now in the days of Saul, that is the Reubenites, made war with the Hagrites, who fell by their hand. And they dwelt in their tents throughout the entire area east of Gilead. And again in verses 19 to 20, they made war with the Hagrites, Jeter, Naphish, and Nodab. And they were helped against them, and the Hagrites were delivered into their hand, and all who were with them, for they cried out to God in the battle. He heeded their prayer, because they put their trust in him. So these Hagrites, whoever they were descended from, lived to the east of the Jordan River, somewhere near the territory of Reuben, and Reuben took over their territory during the days of Saul. Another unfamiliar nation listed here is Gebel. And we don't know much at all about Gebel, not really mentioned again in the scriptures. Many commentators think that this was an area south of the Dead Sea, a mountainous region south of the Dead Sea, but even that cannot be certain. Another thing that's interesting about these various nations here in this list is that many of them were related to Israel. Edom, of course, was descended from Esau, the brother of Jacob. Ishmael was descended from Abraham. Moab and Ammon were descended from Lot, the nephew of Abraham. Amalek was a grandson of Esau. So there are many relatives of Israel found in this list of nations. And some of these relatives, in fact, were relatives whom God forbade Israel to attack as they were making their way from Egypt to Canaan. He forbade them to take any of the territory of Moab and Ammon and Edom. And Jehoshaphat actually makes reference to that in his prayer against Moab and Ammon and Edom, saying, we did nothing to them as we were coming, and yet here they are repaying us by trying to take away our land. But Amalek was a nation that God had doomed to destruction for their attack on Israel at Rephidim during the wilderness wanderings. And God had assigned that task of destroying Amalek to Saul, who had failed to be obedient. And I think the really key thing about these nations that we find mentioned here is that when you start to look at them geographically, what you see is that these nations are on all sides of the land of Israel. Philistia, mentioned in this list, is to the southwest of Israel, between Israel and the Mediterranean Sea, and also toward the south. Some of the nations are in that desert area, the Negev, that lay south of the land of Israel. Some of them are in the east of the Dead Sea and of the Jordan River. Assyria comes from the northeast, and the city of Tyre, of course, was on the coast of the Mediterranean Sea, north of the land of Israel. So what we have here is a depiction of Israel surrounded by enemies, beleaguered by these enemies. All these enemies gathered together to take counsel against Israel in order to destroy it. There's strong emphasis in the Psalm, in fact, on their consulting together. Notice that. Beginning in verse 3, they have taken crafty counsel against your people and consulted together against your sheltered ones. Their counsels are described in verse 4. They have said, come and let us cut them off from being a nation, that the name of Israel may be remembered no more. Again in verse 5, for they have consulted together with one consent. They form a confederacy against you. And also in verse 8, Assyria also has joined with them. They have helped the children of Lot. A couple of things that we should notice about the words used there to describe this council. We have, first of all, those words crafty counsel in verse 3. The word counsel there is the same word that's found in Psalm 25, verse 14. The secret of the Lord is with those who fear him, and he will show them his covenant. We saw when we were looking at that psalm that the secret of the Lord there is, the idea is the secret counsel of the Lord. Secret counsel of the Lord is with those who fear him. And we used as an illustration of that secret counsel of the Lord, which is with those who fear him, God's revelation to Abraham of his purposes with regard to Sodom and Gomorrah, as recorded in Genesis 19. God is talking to himself there, first of all, and he says, shall I tell Abraham about what I'm going to do? And then he says, yes, because I know that he's going to be serving me. He reveals his secret counsel. In that context, that is the context of God's secret counsel, I think that word comes very close to, in meaning, to the New Testament word mystery. God has these things in his counsel that he reveals to his people. The mystery of the gathering of the Gentiles, for example, which was declared and made evident through the Apostle Paul. But here in this context, it simply means that these nations are gathered together against God's people in secret, that they do not want Israel to know about this until they have actually made their attack and hopefully gained an advantage against them. Asaph adds to that word then, secret counsel, the word crafty. They're deceitful, they're full of guile, they're full of trickery as they're taking their counsel. The second word that we want to note in these verses is the word confederacy in the second part of verse 5. That word is actually the word covenant. And the language there is the very same language that's used throughout the Old Testament scriptures of God making his covenant with his people, with Abraham and with David and with the people of Israel at Mount Sinai. They make a covenant against you. And of course, what the idea is that these nations are binding themselves by solemn promises to each other and accepting for themselves a curse, which they say they hope will come upon them if they break their covenant with the other nations. So these nations then are gathered together, they're taking counsel, and their one purpose is to cut off Israel from being a nation. They take counsel, verse 3 says, against your people and consult together against your sheltered ones. It's a somewhat unusual term, but there's an allusion in that term, sheltered ones, to a passage like Psalm 27, verse 5. For in the time of trouble he shall hide me in his pavilion. In the secret place of his tabernacle he shall hide me. He shall set me high upon a rock. So we have the idea of God gathering his people together into his temple, into his pavilion, to shelter them from the attacks of their enemies, or God gathering his people under his wings to protect them from those enemies who desire their destruction. But anyway, that idea of God caring for and protecting his people against the hostility of their enemies, and their enemies not deterred by this fact, but rather still taking counsel, still working together for Israel's destruction. So Israel, Asaph feels Israel to be beleaguered here, to be in very desperate straits as all of these enemies, these many enemies, are gathered together against her. And then one more thing about these verses. Notice that Asaph not only talks about these nations as enemies of Israel, but as enemies of God. Verse 2, for behold, your enemies make a tumult, and those who hate you have lifted up their head. And in verse 5, they form a confederacy or make a covenant against you. Their hostility to Israel then is rooted in their hostility to God. They are driven, probably in their own minds, simply by the desire for Israel's territory. But ultimately, they are driven by the enmity of the serpent against the seed of the woman, and of all the servants of the seed of the serpent against that seed of the woman. And in being motivated against the seed of the woman, they are motivated against God and against God's rule in the world. They are saying, come, let us break their bands and cast off their cords. But Asaph makes use of that fact in his petition. He says, as it were, to God, help us. Help us, if not for our sakes, because you take compassion on the pitiable state of your people, but help us then for your own sake, for the defense of your own honor and for the defense of your own glory. These are not just our enemies, but they are your enemies. And we should understand that God himself takes the enmity of these nations against his people as enmity against himself. We should be reminded in reading this psalm of Jesus' words to Saul on the road to Damascus. Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me? So, however we understand that League of the Nations, people of God, this is a representation, this psalm is a representation of the antithesis, the war between the seed of the serpent and the seed of the woman, and applicable to the church in any age of the world. Asaph, therefore, makes urgent petition to God on behalf of God's people And on behalf of God's honor, do not keep silent, O God. Do not hold your peace. Do not be still. A threefold petition that God will wake up, begin to speak and to act against his enemies. This is a psalm, then, that's representative of the state of the church in the world, people of God. That's what the psalm's about. It's about the church under attack by its enemies and the enemies of God. And we should, because of that fact, find the psalm appropriate at any time in our songs. That brings us then to the second part of the psalm, verses 9 to 18. What we have in the second part of the psalm is a series of petitions, which we can divide into three groups, I think. In verses 9 to 12, we have a series of petitions, or a group of petitions, that ask God to deal with this confederacy of nations as he dealt with Israel's enemies in the time of the judges. It makes reference to two of the greatest victories that Israel won during that period of the judges. The victory of Barak and Deborah against the Canaanites, and the victory of Gideon and his 300 against the Midianites. These two nations harshly oppressed Israel. In fact, it's in connection with these two nations in Judges chapter 4 and 6, that we find more detailed descriptions of the oppression of Israel by its enemies. And their purpose is given to us in the psalm itself in verse 12, who said, "Let us take for ourselves the pastures of God for a possession." Kishon, Endor, Jabin, Sisera are all names associated with the Canaanites. Sisera was, of course, the captain of the army of the Canaanites. Jabin was their king. Kishon was the place where the great battle of Barak and his men was fought against those Canaanites. Endor, though not mentioned in Judges chapter 4, must have been very close to the brook Kishon, because it's said that Jabin and Sisera perished there. And then you have mention of the Midianite leaders in verse 11. These are the enemies of Gideon. Oreb and Zeeb were princes of Midian, whom Ephraim destroyed at the crossing of the Jordan as they were fleeing from Gideon and his 300 back to their own land. And Zeba and Zalmunna were the kings of Midian, whom Gideon killed with his own hand after the battle was over. The prayer here is, or the reference here is to their death, the death of all these people, especially these leaders of these nations, Midian and the Canaanites, who became as refuse or dung on the earth. I think, people of God, that becoming as dung on the earth is the idea there is that they weren't buried. Their bodies were just thrown on the ground as symbols of the judgment of God upon them. And they rotted, and their corpses became food for the beasts and the birds. So Asaph prays, "Let these enemies now at this present time be like those enemies. Let their bodies also be cast on the ground as dung for the fields." The second group of petitions is in verses 13 to 15, and here the focus is on various metaphors for the wrath of God. We have three different metaphors here. First of them in verse 13, "O my God, make them like the whirling dust, like the chaff before the wind." We're very familiar with that metaphor of chaff, of course, and the whole relation of that metaphor of chaff to the winnowing process that the nations at that time in Israel also used to cleanse their grain. But the idea here is, of course, that there is no substantial grain there, that these nations themselves are nothing more than chaff. And that as the anger of God begins to blow upon them, they will be carried away like the chaff of Israel's winnowing. The other half of that verse is a little bit more difficult. The basic image is the same as that of chaff before the wind, but the word that's translated whirling dust, if you look at other translations, you'll find is sometimes translated differently. Some translate it as wheel. And that's the basic idea of the Hebrew word, make them like the wheel. Others translate it, I believe, as tumbleweed. The idea of that word is that it refers to something round. And so a whirlwind, as our translation takes it, or a wheel, or a plant of that general geographic region that was similar to our tumbleweed that could be carried along, rolled along the ground by the wind. Whatever it is, but you see, whatever that is, it's still, you get that same idea of the insubstantiality of these nations before the wrath of God. In the next, the fire becomes the metaphor for God's wrath. As the fire burns the woods and as the flame sets the mountains on fire, an all-consuming and very fierce fire that will burn up the nations. And that metaphor carries right on into the next one, the metaphor of a great storm. As the flame sets the mountains on fire, so pursue them with your tempest and frighten them with your storm. A very violent storm, even a hurricane. Very destructive in its effects and very frightening to these enemies of God's people. And then in verse 15, or verses 16 to 18, you have another series of petitions that's basically related to the idea of putting to shame. Fill their faces with shame. Let them be confounded and dismayed forever. Yes, let them be put to shame and perish. We've seen before that that idea of putting to shame has two things connected with it. One is the idea of frustrating their plans. Disappoint them. Do not allow them to fulfill their intentions against your people. And through frustrating their plans, bring upon them shame and humiliation. Humiliation in their own eyes and humiliation in the eyes of the nations around them. Think, for example, of how Midian must have been ashamed in the victory which Gideon's 300 won over them. But one of the very interesting and perhaps almost unique features of this final group of petitions is that second line of verse 16, fill their faces with shame, that they may seek your name, O Lord. Asaph has in mind here the perishing of these nations. That's part of verse 17. Yes, let them be put to shame and perish. But also, through this shaming of them, this disappointment of their hopes, let them learn to seek your name, O Lord. There is a twofold effect of the judgment of God on these nations. There is the effect of destruction, but there is also that effect that makes them, through this judgment of God, seek his name. And we see that purpose of God also being fulfilled as God, by the sword of his Spirit, works in all nations around us. Not only to bring the nations to destruction, but also to bring some out of them to seek his name. But whatever the effect may be of that judgment of God, there's one great end that the psalm also points us to in verse 18. Whether it be perishing or seeking God's name, these nations, psalmist says, must be put to shame that they may know that you, whose name alone is the Lord, are the Most High over all the earth. God is great. The God of Israel is very great. He is Yahweh, the eternal, self-sufficient, unchangeable God. He is the Most High over all the earth. There is no name greater than his name. No God greater than he. No nation that can exalt itself against him. There is no imagination of men that can encompass his majesty. And men will know. The psalmist prays that they may know, and they will know. They have continued to come to know through all the history of the world. Know better now, as the Lord Jesus Christ sits at the right hand of God, than they have known in the past. And ultimately they will see the Lord Jesus Christ coming in his glory as the Most High over all the earth. How appropriate then is this psalm for our own songs? We recognize certain differences between our own times and the times that the psalm was written. There's no longer this physical division of nations that existed at that time. One nation designated as the people of God and all the other nations around it, opposed to that nation and seeking to destroy it. The battle is of a more spiritual character in the New Testament than it was in the Old Testament. They do not come necessarily with weapons of physical warfare, and we certainly do not oppose them with weapons of physical warfare. But the battle still exists, and the division between the seed of the woman and the seed of the serpent is still there. We, under attack by this great confederacy of our enemies, and opposing them, and wielding the sword of the Spirit against them. It's certainly also true, people of God, that if not always, at least at many times in the history of the world, the church has been in desperate straits, as she was here in this psalm. All of these enemies gathered together, consulting together, allied. Often allied in such a way that they still make war among themselves, but nevertheless having a common purpose that unites them in many cases and in many of their efforts. And that common purpose, the destruction of God's people and the possession of their inheritance. It is that enmity of the nations of the world against the people of God that explains the intensity of this prayer. And I dare say that when the church feels herself as beleaguered as Israel did at this time, she will pray with the same intensity. It's a prayer of love for God and his people. In fact, the intensity of the prayer is driven by the intensity of that love for God and his people. It's a prayer for judgment on the nations. But it's a prayer for judgment that does not exclude the possibility of salvation. Let them be confounded and dismayed, yes, but that they may seek your name, O Lord. So it's our battle song as we stand in the midst of that battle today, opposing the enemies of God and of his church. We should find it very natural to sing this psalm. Not a struggle. We should not find the psalm inappropriate for our times and circumstances. It should arise for us very naturally. Do not be silent, O God. Do not hold your peace. Do not be still. Put them to shame and make them perish that they may know that you, whose name alone is the Lord, are the Most High over all the earth. May God bless the proclamation of his word.